But then I think it also gets us back to where we started in terms of the eclipse. There's one world.
Oh, yeah.
We're here.
Yeah, yeah.
How are we going to do it? Care for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial, 102.9. Here in the studio again today with my climate guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well, Steve. A pleasure to be here.
Oh, good. And it's kind of current events. You saw the eclipse.
I saw the eclipse, and my eyes are still...
They're still okay.
They're still okay, thank goodness. But they're starry-eyed now.
They're starry-eyed. Yeah, you have seen the glory.
And it was pretty very impressive. We had the good fortune to... We drove up to actually Franconia Notch area, right, in New Hampshire, where we were able to get a hotel. We got our hotel a couple months ago. Other people
well
got
in
them
advance.
Years ago.
Certainly.
And we got ours for a more reasonable price.
Yep.
So we got to Franconia and then decided the next day we would shoot up into northern Vermont, which
right.
is not that far away, and try and get into the what's called the totality.
Correct.
Where the eclipse. So for people here in Franklin in southern Massachusetts, it was basically some of the sun was still showing, so you could, if you had the glasses, you could look at it and see the moon in front of the sun. But there in that particular path across northern Vermont, the moon exactly blocked out the entire sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really quite interesting. We had great good fortune of having a place that was not too crowded, peopled, right, to watch, right? So it's not a crazy atmosphere.
Right.
By a lake. And it was really pretty spectacular that you could watch the moon move in front of the sun. And then for 3 minutes, it just got dark mm-hmm. and cold. And the quality of the light changed. And I the only thing I can think is that regular sunlight has yellow wavelengths in it, all red, a lot of red and yellow. But when the moon is blocking the sun, all the light that's getting to Earth is coming from the halo, which is kind of reflected light from the gases around the sun.
Sure.
And that's just different color set. So yes. everything looked more gray. And, yeah, there was like, as they said, a sunset all the way around, 360-degree sunset, and really very interesting. One of those things that you do once in your life because you can, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I observed it to the extent that I did because it was really kind of a non-event mostly here. I didn't have the glasses and wasn't looking specifically up, but I was watching the shadows on the ground, and the shadows really didn't change a heck of a lot on the ground because mm-hmm. we were in that 90% range. Mm-hmm. It really didn't change a whole lot.
Well, that was just one of the interesting things that I took out of the totality experience
mm-hmm.
was that the moon, of course, is marching along, slowly covering more and more of the disk of the sun.
Right.
And the switch is almost like a light switch, because even a little tiny bit of the sun shining still gives you a fair amount of light.
It does.
And then once it's blocked, it gets quite dark.
Right.
But then on the exit side, when the moon moves away from the sun, bammo.
Bingo.
There's a lot of light comes back just from the tiny. And I guess the implication is how incredibly powerful the sun is, how much light we are getting from
it, yeah.
how much energy. We can talk about the connection to energy, but there's a huge amount of energy coming from the sun, and that tiny sliver of the sun that was exposed completely changed the amount of light that you mm-hmm. have on the ground.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too, because to that, one of our Franklin residents in one of the social channels, and I forget exactly which one or where, but it doesn't matter. The point was he shared a chart of his solar panel. And indeed, there was a V on that Monday, and it didn't go all the way to zero, which, to the point, at least here, we weren't in the totality, so we didn't totally go dark. But there was a significant dip in his output during those minutes.
There's two things there. One is that we should talk about just the kind of the spiritual experience of an eclipse and sort of the implications if you have a climate mindset. But the flip, the other side is much more pragmatic, is the in science, there's something called a natural experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So a natural experiment is when something is happening that you can't control as a scientist, but you can observe it.
And you can measure it appropriately so that because it'd be hard to reconstruct.
And so for ISO New England, the people who manage the grid, they do not have an exact number of how many solar panels are on people's houses or on businesses.
Sure.
And that is referred to as the solar power that is behind the meter.
Yep.
Right. So the grid, ISO, the people that supply your power, do not know how much solar power there is out there hiding behind people's houses, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't control it. Right. So this is an opportunity, because the sun went out, it sort of tells you how much solar energy was being generated 5 minutes ago when there was sunlight,
right,
versus now. And you can estimate how much of our energy is being generated by solar panels on people's roofs that's not owned and controlled by ISO New England. So it's quite an interesting. There's, if you look at the ISO New England app that Jeff Roy has urged upon us, you can see the big drop off in the generated power and the increase. They had to turn on some of the gas powered plants
in order to
match
to cover
that short interval.
Yeah.
And the take home lesson is that as the grid evolves, and you know there'll be other circumstances where the solar panels get hidden or don't produce as much because the sun's hidden, that's where the whole idea of battery storage comes in. You need batteries to be around when the sun's not shining for the 3 minutes. So we got to start preparing for the next eclipse in 2044 or something.
Yeah, and clearly the other point within that is the data is really the king in that case. And to the extent that even at an ISO New England, if they don't have this pool identified that John Doe, Jane Doe, Sue, whoever have these devices that generate solar power, they don't know that. Even at a grand scale, they can see the effect.
Right.
But at a grand scale, so if the track of the next one is slightly different, they may still not be able to fully enumerate or instrumentate what they're going to need to do, because how much of an effect was it clearly in the totality panned through upper Vermont?
Right.
That was a key piece, but us in Maine, New Hampshire, Mass, Connecticut, Rhode Island, you know, had less of an effect. So,
the data is
the key.
It's
really
a very, so now we're geeking out.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
We're going ISO New England. What we're talking about is ISO, of course, is the people who run the electric grid. They have to produce enough electricity to keep all of New England functioning. And they think a lot about it. A lot of control. They're measuring everything, right? In the past, before there were solar panels, the demand for electricity peaked in the late afternoon, right? Sort of noontime to 5, and that's
right.
As the evening went on, people would go to bed, and the demand for electricity would go down. What's happening nowadays, since the invention of the solar cells and wind turbines, is that the amount of power that ISO is requested to generate goes down, and in the middle of the day, they don't have to make any power because there's more and more solar panels making
out there,
that are out there.
Sure.
And so the historical norms of when ISO needs to produce power, it's all getting shaken up.
Sure.
Because now, in midday, they don't need to make anything, and it's only sort of in the evening when they need to make stuff, and then you're back to batteries, because if you could charge up the batteries, they wouldn't need to make anything in the evening either.
Yeah.
So it's very... That's a long way from the eclipse, but it is an interesting, telling thing about how we generate our power, how we measure it. Not everyone has to really care about ISO New England, and I urge you, if you don't have to, don't worry about it too much. But there's a lot of thought that goes into it, and a lot you can learn. Very interesting topic.
And it comes back to data, which we're data geeks as well. So, so while you went to the eclipse, I went to get some more sunlight to a certain extent by spending 2 days at the State House in what they was the 87th Citizen Legislative Seminar, Apparently, in some earlier days, it required a three-hour commitment over the course of 6 weeks for one day at a time, 18 hours. So they've condensed it. Now we had 2 days, approximately 15 hours. It was
well,
good.
You went to the State House for 2 days of sessions, sort of classes.
Effectively, yep, yep. So we got our got nominated, applied, submitted bios. We got a package when we went. There were 43 of us or something like that, effectively one per senator in to that extent. So mm-hmm. we each had a seat in the Senate chambers, and there are only 40 seats because there are 40 senators, and that goes back, yada, yada, yada. Did get a State House tour amongst that. Did manage to stop by our Rep. Roy's office in the morning on Tuesday because it fit my schedule and his schedule. So, yeah, it, to the extent that I've learned as much as I have in the course of
What was the I don't want to call it a class, but it was like a conference. It was an opportunity. Well, what was the point of it?
Yeah, it's meant to be a citizens' legislative seminar. So citizens' understanding of the legislative process. So to the extent that I've been reporting and hearing from Senate President Spilka, who was our senator, Senator Rausch now, Jeff Roy, our state rep, I've gotten a pretty decent understanding of what happens when you file a bill, and there's a cycle to a bill filing over a course of a two-year session, mm-hmm. right? Because that's the court. The general court runs for 2 years.
Okay.
They file a bill. The bill gets assigned to a committee. Committees hold hearings. And then the committee will report out, and there's a whole lot of details around that. Some of that I was able to pick up over the course of my experience. So I wasn't learning a whole lot net new, but it was reconfirming what I had heard and giving me some a little different details, a little more understanding of the entire process. And it's an amazing process.
So I want to rename the street I live on to Unicorn Way.
Mm-hmm.
I want to write a bill to do that. What's the process?
That would be locally, generally. So the local town, city, whatever, their ordinances.
I want to rename Norfolk County to Unicorn County.
Right. That certainly would require a legislative act and likely would have to, because if it was a county one, would have to get sponsored through the county. And then because it's a state entity, actually then get approved by both House and Senate. So, yeah, a citizen's petition, and either of us can draft legislation and propose it. It would get assigned a bill number, potentially assigned a committee. Committee potentially would include it in whatever else of that topic for a hearing. And if it goes through, could get reported out of the committee with... Yes.
Reporting out of the committee means it approves the bill.
They've encouraged it for further action. Yeah. In some cases, the House or the Senate, wherever it originated, would. And just quickly on that, any money bills come out of the House, still go to the Senate, but the Senate wouldn't originate a money bill.
Right.
That's the House's responsibility.
Right.
So it would have to go through the two of them. So assuming it starts in the Senate, it reads out, and they say yay, then there would be a Senate vote on it, assuming it passed, then it would get referred to the House. The House would pick it up, assuming it passed. If there was no differences, then it would go before the governor to be signed and enacted. If there were differences in the course of the discussion between Senate and House,
the bill, the language of the bill in each of the two houses,
then that leads to the conference committee we've heard from time to time, where they've passed this bill and the House has got their version, and then there's three people from each, the Senate and the House, who then are in charge with reconciling the differences in order to bring it forward. It still goes back to both for them to approve the changes before going for the governor.
Wow.
So more and more details around that process. They got into the budget hearings, House floor, Senate floor, well, focused on the Senate because we were in the Senate. So we were one of the Senate rooms, one of their session rooms was where most of our actions took place. We did get a tour of the State House, relatively brief. It was within an hour. I don't know if that's, quote, the full State House tour if we were to take mm-hmm. as a citizen. But that was interesting in itself. We also did a mock session. So during the course of the first day, we were learning about the legislative process, then they also gave us the draft of a bottle bill that actually had been filed in the Senate and gone through some hearings. So we got, as part of our package, pros and cons from various advocacy groups, public media companies. So Mass Live had a reporting of pros and cons on it. So all this became our understanding of the package.
You were acting as the senators.
We were going to act each individually as a senator.
Right.
And in fact, in that Wednesday morning starting session, we were in the Senate chamber. We got called to order in a practice role-playing situation. So Senator Lovely actually led us. She was the Senate president at the time. Uh-huh. The real Senate clerk was there. And we went through hearing four amendments that were proposed by...
To this bottle bill.
To this bottle bill that had been created by the class. I had an opportunity to do so because I was reporting on the school committee meeting the night before. I didn't have a chance to do it, but somebody did. They had four generally good amendments that really caused me to pause and think about, well, yeah, this is not so easy a decision. Mm-hmm. And for those, at least in terms of the gist of it, the bottle bill, as we know, when it was passed, something in the 80s, created a 5-cent deposit and only covered certain bottle types. So the water bottles that we see prevalent, the nips that we see prevalent, those are not covered. And oh, by the way, there's a whole lot of other containers that have since been introduced by the market. Mm-hmm. So the bottle bill is intended to expand, and then in this particular version, increase. And then that was part of the amendment discussion, because one said, well, 5 cents in 1980 is really like 1.3 cents today. Let's go to 15 to at least give it more of, because the other piece is it's not just us who are purchasing, pay the deposit, and then have to come back and get the deposit back. It's the people in the middle, the stores and the retail operations and the recyclers. They get some of that 15 cents or 5 cents for their handling costs, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they would benefit instead of, you know, at least getting something to cover their costs today. They got to be losing money on the 5 cents,
right?
So, yeah, it was an interesting discussion. They actually produced at the end of it kind of the folded paper as if it was a real bill from the Senate showing the yeas and the nays. And in our case, it had passed. So it would procedurally go forward if there was a House thing, et cetera. So, but to be in, and if you haven't taken the tour yet, clearly it is the citizens' house.
The state house.
It is our house. It's free to go. I encourage you just to go. You can walk in.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
walk around. It's amazing. We've seen the Gold Dome. The Gold Dome is actually in the Senate chambers.
Oh, really?
Which at one point in time was actually the House chambers initially. And the Senate used what they now call kind of the lunch or reading room. That was the Senate chambers. The House at one point had up to 200 legislators sitting on risers in that small room.
Oh, really?
That now sits 40, mm-hmm. seats 40 rather comfortably in that particular session. They then expanded the state house, creating the House portion now in the other wing. So they've got theirs, et cetera. The other little tidbit, the sacred cod resides in the House chambers.
The sacred cod is just, that is a, like a
it's a kind of a
Billy
wooden,
Bass
it's
kind
a,
of
kind
thing.
Of a, well, it's a replica of a cod.
Okay.
And it's a big device. Big replica of a cod.
Made out of wood or something.
Wood or something. It was done a long time ago because apparently at some point in time, and I don't remember the exact years, I probably should have prepared a little better, kept those notes. But the House suspended operations because some students from Harvard stole it as part of a prank or something. Although I know MIT's been very familiar with pranks. Harvard apparently stole it for a couple of days. And then miraculously it appeared back on the state house lawn, so they reinstored it into the House chambers. House resumed, but now it's hung from the ceiling to make it a little less more difficult, a little bit harder to get to.
Interesting.
Coincidentally, in the Senate chambers, up above the chandelier is the holy mackerel. A smaller version of the mackerel, and it's referred to as the holy mackerel. So they each have their fish, which clearly fishing had been primary as part of the economy of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Well, I think your point that the State House is the People's House is really an important thing to reiterate, in that you go in there, it is like going into a church. It is, and for me, every time I go in, I say, this building represents my commitment to democracy and the continuity of all these good things, right? And so to have it made out of marble and, you know, permanent looking, for me, that's a good thing, because this is where we should be spending our money, is in committing to our commitment to good government, right? And, and as you walk through the State House, it is a beautiful building. And you go in, if you're familiar with it, you go to Park Station, the MBTA stop, walk up the hill towards the Golden Dome, and just to the right is what's called the Hooker Entrance, right?
Hooker Entrance is under construction, so currently you can't go in that way. You have to walk around the corner to Ashburton Place entrance.
And get in that
way. And enter that way. They do have a security check. Relatively like any other security check that you've been through, whether at Gillette Stadium or certainly TSA at an airport.
And you can walk, but I mean, you get inside, and I mean, this is the room where it happens, right? And you can go in, you can talk to your representatives, you can, like the Hall of Flags. I mean,
it's the Hall of Flags. Beautiful, it's amazing, gorgeous,
beautiful places to walk around, and it's yours. I mean, and it represents your government.
As akin to like a church and a place of reverence, it's also a living museum, to the extent that there are artifacts and gifts to the Commonwealth that have been given over the years by various entities, certainly royalty, et cetera. And they're in there in some rooms or displayed. If it's a bust, it's here, it's there.
That's a great thing.
And to the extent that it is open, we were in the Senate. Senate chambers for the session itself, but we were in one of the Senate rooms, and I was hearing it was almost like there was a high school cheerleading practice, and there it was, an active group, some 30 or so folks who were periodically chanting for whatever they were advocating for. It was just enough so that we could hear it, but I couldn't hear what they were advocating for. It's that kind of public place.
You can go and do that.
Certainly we've seen from time to time, you know, the news says, well, so-and-so was removed because they were violating their, you know, space allotment or whatever. And yeah, those things happened, but I didn't see that while we were there. There was a sense of decorum. I mean, we also had to wear a tie and a jacket for the men. Ladies had to be dressed. It was cool.
That is great. Well, and all this stuff matters. This is a discussion of climate. I mean, all this stuff matters because I've been to the State House and done those kind of chants outside the governor's office, which, again, you respect the system, right? You're not there to disrupt anything.
Right.
But you go, if you get a chance to go to the State House, the governor's office kind of overlooks this grand staircase, marble staircase, lined with, so it's a two-story atrium. You go up and you come around and get to the governor's office.
Right.
But you can stand in that atrium and chant, and there, it happens all the time. People, all the staffers know it's all okay. You know, if you behave, they are more than happy to talk to you.
Yep.
And it's quite an experience. So if you get a chance to lobby your state representative or senator about climate issues, go do it just for the hoot of it, because it really is fun.
Or on just the plus side, to arrange with your local state rep, state senator, et cetera, and get a tour. They'll be happy to do that. And I know Jeff Roy welcomes tours. Obviously, he'll schedule to make sure he can devote some time. He's a fount of knowledge, I'm sure. I had to catch a train because we had some other meetings on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. A couple of my colleagues were going over to see Senator Rausch. I sent her my regards. They said, unfortunately, I've got to catch the train in order to make the meeting. I did catch the train.
Did you
say, make the meeting.
Please fix the MBTA so that it runs more frequently?
That would be one of my side notes. So I missed your personal session, but you know, I see her frequently enough. I don't didn't have to see her there. Uh-huh. I definitely will send her a note because in the council, in the Senate chambers, I actually got to sit in her seat, which was a unique perspective on the world. So, that was cool.
They say down in Washington, D.C., of course, is very similar.
Yeah.
But you can go to the desks in the Senate and you open it up and it says, you know, Jack Kennedy cut into the wood of the desk.
Yeah. We were advised that since the Senate was in session, going to be the next day, et cetera, kind of leave the desk alone. The other piece that was rather interesting, too, some of the seats were kind of a little bit higher and lower. Mm-hmm. Apparently, they're set that way, depending upon the physical body of the senator in that seat. The height of the seat is so that they're all at eye level. That's an attention to detail. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Right? In terms of equality, we talk about equality, justice. We're all at the same eye level when it comes down to that.
I mean, I'm thinking one of the things that I have committed to, I've never done it, but the JFK Library,
yes.
Speaking of marvelous places, yes. I'm told, has a recreation of the U.S. Senate, the United States Senate in mm-hmm. D.C., built in the library up in Boston just off I-93.
Yep.
It's something you can go and take advantage of as well.
Yeah. I've been there once upon a time. I do want to go back, especially now that I'm in this role. I want to do some different things to the extent that there's a Senate chamber there. Absolutely. Next to it as well is the State Archives. And that was one of our sessions. So he brought in, was one of the archivists brought in a brass plate that actually had been carved, not was worked, because it's brass, by Paul Revere. And they have it because on the backside, it still has the stamps. So it's an official state record, even though on the front side, he had used it as a plate to print something else. But on the other side, it becomes a state record. So we get into those kinds of details. What do they have? How do they have it? And he held it with white gloves.
I bet he did. Well, speaking of holding those things, with treasuring those things, so here's a downer for you. I mean, the Kennedy Library, if you're familiar with that area, right, that's going to get flooded.
Yes.
So what the heck do we have the State Archives in a flood zone? Same way I believe I read somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that the Boston City Archives are like in the basement of City Hall. Yeah. So if it floods, they're going to get damaged.
And the archives were moved out there because for many years they were in the basement of the Capitol building in not so good conditions. Mm-hmm. And they've got an original copy of such and such. And because of its water damage and such, you can imagine if you've seen books, the pages are kind of like so stuck together that they have it. They're not opening it. Right. It would just truly damage
deferring it to some future
maybe somebody will have some technology to figure it out how to handle it better than we can today. So, but it's in the archives.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's a great experience for you.
It was.
Is it going to do it again next year? Will it be offered next year?
Supposedly twice a year. So you can reach out to for Franklinners, reach out to Senator Rausch and say, oh, by the way, if there is another session, I heard I'd like to participate. And throw your name in the hat and, you know, see what
happens.
Presumably
that can happen to anybody in Massachusetts who's listening and to their own senator.
Right, because clearly of the 40-something that were there, there were people from Western Mass, people from Boston, people from Wrentham, Norfolk, et cetera. There were from, I can't say, certainly not all 351 cities were represented, but there was at least 40 representing the districts accordingly our representative form of government.
That's great. That's great.
Other things happened in the meantime. While you were eclipsing and I was statehousing, there was at least an article that came across my radar that, you know, we talk about data, we talk about the 80-20 rule. I think it was in The Guardian, had the list of the 57 companies that actually contribute the bulk of the fossil fuels emissions. So the 80-20 rule in this case, it's 57 companies.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to think about the issue, because oftentimes climate stuff, in particular, you know, the carbon pollution, the CO2 that you generate in your personal life from driving a car or cooking your dinner, right, somehow has been ascribed to you personally and your carbon footprint, that you are driving a car and that's your responsibility, and you should feel guilty about it and do something about it, which is a legitimate discussion. But a different lens to view the discussion through is to say that the carbon pollution that we're all dealing with from a global perspective comes from an extraordinarily, how shall I say, is mediated, passes through the hands of an extraordinarily small set of companies. So it's something like 50, as you said, Steve, 57 companies constitute the majority of the business procurement and delivery of fossil fuels, right? And of course, that changes the picture, because now you're talking to 57 CEOs, just as a number. I'm sure, depending on how you analyze it, you can get different numbers, right?
Yeah.
But 57 CEOs who all are trying to preserve their own position in life, right? Like the business the way it is. And they have a much different leverage on the question of who's doing the polluting, right? If you say, boy, we could talk to those 57 companies and get them to back off, that would go a long way to helping you and me and the guy next door to reduce our carbon footprint, because there wouldn't be, you know, it's a control point that's much more precise than bazillions of cars that are on the road and trying to control all of them individually. So I think, and so this analysis has gone on for a while, of the relatively few hands that fossil fuels, that is to say oil, gas, natural gas, all that passes through. And that then is a predicate to talk about how the corporate control of the fossil fuel industry and the self-interest of people like ExxonMobil, right, who I think the article says like 1.5% of global pollution comes from ExxonMobil, right? It comes from ExxonMobil in the sense that ExxonMobil is making sure you've got that gas, and they're not doing anything about backing off. They're going to make up a story and tell you that they're going to create, you know, green algae that in some future time will replace the gasoline. But basically, they are pushing the gasoline story. So this kind of article is a good way to shift your perspective on how to address the entire systemic climate change thing, because it's a small number of companies that are doing it. You could dial every one of them up, talk to them. It's a different thing than trying to get everybody to stop driving their cars so much. It's just a different statement of the problem, although it's highly related.
Right. Yeah. And one of the other articles that I came across the radar as well was one where listed some of the disinformation campaigns that some of the greenwashing is being used by the fossil companies to highlight their supposed efforts, and yet in fact they're doing something else. And related to that in specific, the New York Attorney General has actually sued JBS, one of the largest meat providers, specifically because of their claims as to how they are trying to attack climate, when in fact they're not, according to the challenge.
I mean, it really, yeah. So, I mean, the place to begin there is that the production of meat, in particular beef, is incredibly, creates an amazing amount of carbon dioxide, right? From the methane that the cows, you know, release to the inputs, to growing the grain that gets fed to the cows, to keeping the cows alive and well, transporting all that meat. It's a very big amount of carbon that's tied up in that pound of steak that you have, that hamburger you have. And so one of the big things that people say is you can make a significant climate impact from your personal footprint. Forget everything I just said about 57 companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Personally, if you ate one less meat meal a week, you would have a big impact on your climate, your carbon footprint, just because that meat has so much carbon dioxide associated with it.
Right.
And so the fact that Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, would go and sue the company for lying about it.
Yeah, false right? claims. Yeah.
And presumably there's a, if you're going to sue somebody, you have to have a damage, right?
Right.
And you have to have suffered a damage. So somehow New York has suffered a damage because—
false advertising.
And that's really interesting. And it bespeaks all of the different kinds of, I mean, most of the lawsuits that I've heard about are cities and states like Massachusetts suing the Exxon Mobils of the world, the fossil fuel producers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is the first time I heard of suing a meat company because they lied. But again, it comes back to the fact that there's the systemic aspect of the carbon dioxide emissions, when you look at it, there's only so many meat packers out there,
mm-hmm.
right? There's only so many oil companies. You can talk to them and have a pretty big impact in a way that's harder to do by convincing everyone to have, you know, fish on Fridays kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think the other piece to kind of tie back to our state house visit, it's using the process, the legislative process, in this case, the judicial challenge, to, okay, the law was passed. No false advertising. Have they, in fact, and hopefully she'll have elucidated all the points and have present her case, and it'll be heard through, you know, whether it's a jury trial or whatever, there remains to be seen. I didn't read that part of the details, but ultimately there will come out a decision that either, yay, she's right and the people should get compensated. The further implications, that's other speculation in regards to what's going to happen with the meat producers and climate overall. But then I think it also gets us back to where we started in terms of the eclipse. There's one world.
Oh, yeah.
We're here.
Yeah, yeah.
How are we going to do it?
Yeah, I mean, you've got no place to go. There's no planet B. It is literally it's literally a true statement brought home by the fact that the moon can block out the sun, and it just brings home how connected the planet is to the rest of the universe. You can't escape physics.
Right.
But, I mean, I think that the misinformation aspect, so we talk about the meat companies greenwashing and saying, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. we're doing all this good stuff, when in fact they're not. And the 57 fossil fuel companies that are giving us 80% of the fossil fuels, they have a vested interest in continuing circumstances as they are now,
right.
And they are willing to engage in campaigns of what is called, you know, what you would call misinformation, or basically spinning, I would say, to try and put the best possible interpretation on events that absolves those companies from doing anything. Right.
And that's where there's a slight difference between misinformation. Somebody unintentionally passing along incorrect or incomplete info. So clearly, you've got more of a scientific background than I do. I wouldn't claim to be. If I said something, that could be misinformation. Disinformation is the deliberate spread of knowing the right story, but spreading the wrong story. So there is a difference between the two.
Fair enough.
And I have been periodically, in some cases, at least twice a month, I would think. I haven't really gone back and counted, but the FTC has a series of consumer alerts. I subscribe to those. There's a Newslit project that I subscribe to. So when there are good either seminars or like this article, it elucidates five things that are triggers to a disinformation campaign. Be aware of those five. And if you at least see one, then stop and think. What are you looking at? Who's telling you the story? Because there may be something else there. To raise that awareness, because, you and I, and we're fortunate where we are, but
most people don't think, and what I think the companies are trying to do is just basically, as the article said, seed into most people's brains the idea that fossil fuels are a good thing and need to be preserved.
Right.
Right. And that almost the exact detail. You don't remember exactly what the ad was about, but you remember a feel good, a good feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, healthy kids running in green fields. You know, driving a car, yeah. Right? And that's all that matters to these guys. And I would just urge people, next time you see an ad. I was joking before. There's some ad on TV that I see now that mobile is making race car fuel that's going to save the environment. And you just do one of those sort of rut-row kind of Scooby-Doo things. There. Wait a minute. Does that make any sense at all? And, you know, you sort of challenge what comes out of the TV. You got to challenge once in a while or else you, I don't know.
Be aware. Stop. Look and listen.
And think.
So hopefully we've given you listeners a few things to think about. Certainly, if you've got any additional questions or questions on our particular topics, by all means, continue to reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. And Ted, thank you for helping, certainly with your eclipse stories, to help me understand a little bit more about the eclipse and clearly make more sense of climate as we're on this journey. Well, day to day.
It's fun, Steve. And the eclipse was pretty impressive. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And listeners, quick reminder, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.